Hi, everyone. I'm the girl in that picture 35 years ago. Gosh, and I look like a marshmallow and a meringue. I can tell you, it was hilarious. When I look back on it now, it really is funny to see what we turned up in for our weddings. But I was, I actually bought that dress in Harrods. There you go. That's my little bit of name dropping. It was on the sales rack, but nonetheless, it was in Harrods. And I was travelling with a girlfriend. Life was so different then. You didn't think about going with your mum to buy your dress. It wasn't a big deal. It was like, oh, well, I'm here having a look. Oh, that looks okay. I'll wear that. And, then you kind of fall forward and think 35 years later, who could have imagined? Who could imagine, like, lasting that long with one person? Seriously. That's a challenge, isn't it? Do you feel as challenged? It is actually funny. Funniest thing is that people think Cheesy doesn't look the same, and he does to me because I remember him looking like that. So when someone says, I can't recognise him, I'm thinking, well, who else is it? You know, I didn't get dressed up for some other fellow. So my name is Kelly, and I'm going to be introducing a little chat about kingdomism. Kingdomism, which is our theme, which we've been running for since Easter, and kind of capturing in its essence the Sermon on the Mount. And it's a term, I think, that Phil actually coined the term kingdomism. And it means it's like most other isms, you know. Well, it's not, but, you know, it's a term like most other isms, you know, socialism, communism. And the whole idea is that an ism is like a theory, a philosophy, a way of looking at the world. And so our kingdomism is saying we look at the world through the prism of Scripture and Christ himself. That's actually what kingdomism is. Let's look at the way we live, not through all these other filters, but let's look at it through Christ and even more specifically, Christ's words. And I really love it as a thought. We've defined this idea, it rejects as a polarising reality, rejects polarising people, but it embraces a world that looks like God. Let's have a world that looks like God. Let's live out a world that looks like God. You know, the biggest risk, I think, in adopting an ism is that it remains a philosophy, doesn't it? Just remains a concept. Like, we know most philosophies can sound great in principle, a really great way to live life, share what we have with others. But when it actually gets reduced to the way that people live, that's actually what matters. And at West City, may we not have a philosophy of kingdomism, may we have a culture of kingdomism. Not what we say, this is how we live. Then how shall we live? And that's why we started off this whole series with the story that Jesus told about building your house on the rock. And the idea that if you want to build your house on a rock, then you don't actually just hear these words, you do them. In fact, the lead-in, the opposite, said this: everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain fell, because it's going to come, the floods are going to come. Let's not be so naive to think in the kingdom means there are no floods and no rains, because they will surely come. And the winds will blow and they'll beat on your house, but it does not fall because it has been founded on the rock. But the opposite is also true. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rain fell and the same floods came and the same winds blew and blew against that house and it fell, and great was the fall of it. We led with that story by Jesus because we say kingdomism cannot remain an ism. Kingdomism must become a culture. The way that all of us say, how then shall we live? I will live like this. And today I'm going to talk about, I reckon, a fairly fundamental part of that. And that's the idea of judging others. The idea of judgment. The idea of us bringing judgment against someone else. And boy, I reckon it's really hard not to live like this. Not hard. I was recently in Hong Kong, only a week or so ago, and I was there for an international development conference. And as the end of the conference, on the last day, we went to a simulation exercise. And it put us into about 70 aid workers. We were in a big room, maybe not much bigger than this. And we sat down for about half an hour and we talked about, you know, poverty and what were the words we would associate with poverty and what are the things that we're all doing to address poverty. And we're having this fantastic theoryism about development work. And as we sat there, they then said to us, oh, well, now we're going to actually have a bit of an exercise. And they said the average slum community, the space given to each family in a slum community is about 2 metres by 2 metres. So they put down around the room plastic mats 2 metres by 2 metres. And they said the average family living on that would be 7 people. So we were divided into groups of 7 on our 2 metre by 2 metre mat. And then in the corner, they had like a makeshift couple of shops and they had a little space where charity workers could be and had a few other things that would be in that village. And they said, you know what, if you want to have that piece of ground, it'll cost you about $180 a month for the land. And then what you'll have to pay is about $30 for food. If you want to have a toilet, one of those optional extras, you can pay another $30 and you'll get access to one toilet that you will all share. And then they said, and now you're going to now become the workers. And we sat on these mats and we had to make bags out of newspaper. And it was old newspaper, you had to rip them up, and then you had a big tub of water and flour that you mixed together that became your glue. So for the next 2 hours, we made paper bags. And honestly, my legs at the end of this, I was a mess. You know, I was kind of lying on the ground by the end of it. I couldn't even kneel. By the next day, I was, you know, had to be carried basically around the hotel. So we worked like fiends. And we could never catch up to what the usual pay was, even though we were working so hard. And I was so relieved when the exercise was over. And we sat down to do a reflection. And in this reflection, what suddenly became so obvious was all of my thoughts about poverty that I wasn't even aware of I carried had just been so confronted. We can often have a picture of, oh, the poor don't do anything. They wouldn't be poor if they worked hard. And you can be very confronted with the fact you can work very hard. But when systems propagate poverty, it's really difficult to work against them. When I went to the shop to try to sell my bags, my paper bags, the woman gave me good money the first time and I was very delighted. And then I came back the second time and then she said, oh, would you, next time you need to send your son or a boy to come back and sell your bags. I was like, yeah, as if. Went back to my room, back making my bags. I thought, I'll just wait for a little while. She'll forget about me, 70 other people come. And when I went the next time, she looked at me and she said, I told you, I don't want you, I want your son. I thought, this is day one. This is hour one. How would I be? At day 50, day 100, whatever it would be. It was such a confronting exercise, not because you didn't know these things. The other thing that really astounded me is all the time that I was working so hard to make the paper bags, when I sat down, they said to this group of us, and why didn't any of you take advantage of the charity NGO group who was helping you with education and with food and everything? And I said, well, we didn't know. And they said, well, how could you not have known? We were coming to your group and we were yelling it at you. I never heard them. I never heard a word. I was so focused on that all those other do-gooders like me actually weren't heard in the confusion. And I guess what it told me was we can see so quick to judge and we can be so incredibly wrong and not even know it. The words of Matthew 7 say this, judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye when there is a log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of the brother's eye. In some ways, I don't think these scriptures need a whole lot of explanation. I said to Phil, maybe I should just come up in the front and just say, judge not, lest you be judged, and, you know, message over. Our speakers never really mean that. They just pretend, like me. But we could say a sentence like that, and I just think to myself, is it that complicated? The content of this is really clear. We're not talking about, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, yes, then maybe we shouldn't have court systems. No. Or we shouldn't stand up for what we believe. No. It's not what it's saying. We all know what it's saying. It's saying don't judge someone else. Clear. It's talking about you and me in the everyday conversations, engagements of life. Don't judge. I don't think it's hard to understand what it's saying, but gosh, it's hard to live it out. Does anyone else find it hard to live it out? Please. Please. I hope that I'm not this only lonely soul down here who's just thinking, oh my lordy, can it really mean that? I think that we're not just actively judges, but we can be so passively judge as well. When you say, oh, thank goodness someone else is, I'm not like them. When we say, oh gosh, I wish someone else was here to listen to this message this morning. Does anyone else have that thought? It's so tragic, we all do. We're actually judging. We've actually already gone there in our heads. We've already decided who needs this a little bit more than me. And I think we become so blind to our own frailties and weaknesses. Oh, golly. I mean, the story of David is just one of those spectacular examples of it. You know, David in the Old Testament's a king, and David sees a woman he thinks is beautiful and he wants her for himself. And so he organises to send her husband to the front line so that he will be killed and then he can take the wife. And Nathan comes to him and says to him, tells him this story. He says, there was two men in a certain town and one was rich and one was poor. And the rich man had very large numbers of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he bought. And he raised it and it grew up with him and his children and it shared his food, it drank from his cup and it slept in his arms and it was like a daughter to him. And now a traveller came to the rich man. But the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare for the traveller who had come to him. Instead, he goes and takes the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. And he says to David, what do you think of that? And I just think this statement is so amazing. And David burned with anger against the man. And he says to Nathan, as surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. And he must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and he had no pity. Oh, man. Nathan says to David, and you are the man. I think about the times I judge and I think, if I looked at it honestly, I'd say, you are the woman. You are her. I think in our secularism, I say the first reason we do this is actually our humanity makes us so quick to look at someone else and so slow to look at ourselves. We're in a culture of judgment, that is for sure, sure. I mean, if we just look at social media, is a circus. But if we just look at television and reality shows and competitions and on your renovation now, your cooking skills, your singing skills, there's always an opportunity for someone to have a go whether you're quite good enough, isn't it? I'm a cricket passionado, aficionado, whatever it is. I love cricket. Does anyone else love cricket? Love it. Oh, I've got a few cricket supporters here. If you don't know what cricket is, it's a game. That's enough to know. Anything else is going to take too much explanation. But it's a game. And it's a game that Australia's good at. And recently, Australia went to another country, namely South Africa, and in that game was found to have a couple of players on our field who cheated. Maybe I should ask you, have you ever cheated in your life? Ever in your life, have you withheld something? I've had the odd cheat. Also, have you got to confess these things up here, isn't it? But I'm sure I have. Well, I know I have. Well, Australia was outraged. Not only were we outraged, but we wouldn't even leave it to the organisation who is there to judge those things. They're appointed. They're the arbitrators, and they judged, and they made a judgment. But no, we weren't happy with that judgment. I heard friends who have never watched a cricket game in their life say, "I'll never watch it again." I thought, you never had, and who cares? Australia was outraged. I don't know how many millions, but more people came out of the woodwork in that week to talk about cricket than I've ever heard of in my life. And not only were we so outraged that we wanted those men to suffer, that we wanted to pull them in front of the television and say, "You know what, Steve Smith, weep. And let me see your sorrow." And I cried my eyes out that we could do that. How could we do that? When I've sinned and I've cheated and no one even asked for a public confession, but with his public confession we decided, are they sorry enough? Are they sincere enough? Have they been punished enough? And then you know what we do? We move on with our lives and we leave shattered people in our wake. I don't know if you'll ever get over that. I actually truly believe that. I don't know if you'll ever get over it. I don't know if he can ever get over a risk of his own personal judgment, because the world has said, you're not worth it anymore. You've made a mistake. The tragedy is not only is our humanity causes us to judge, but sometimes it's actually our very faith that makes us some of the greatest judges. I always feel a bit uncomfortable talking about this. I love what John Stott says. He says, "Pride is your greatest enemy and humility your greatest friend." You know, sometimes we actually use our faith as an excuse for judgment. It becomes the actual tool of why we can use this. You know, I think about Jesus at the well when the woman, he walks all night to meet her. You know, we know that, John 4. Out and out, my favourite story about Jesus, because he walks all through the night to meet a woman at the well who is a woman who is Samaritan of ill repute. And she's a woman, second class anyway. And he comes there to share with her the secrets of the kingdom. I think about the woman caught in adultery, and here's Jesus saying, "Hey, you know what? Don't judge." His whole example to us is not to be people who judge. And yet our response so quickly within our faith is to be the ones who declare on someone else. I'm involved in an online women's network, and sometimes people put up, it's not Christian, it's about women, it's about supporting women, it's about encouraging women, we say, to live their finest life, and along the way introducing really lovely thoughts about God and how they can meet him. But someone put up a quote that was a bit one of those obscure kind of, you know, self-help kind of quotes about the universe or something. Anyway, it's okay. And I struggled to understand the number of Christians who wanted to respond to that and put it right and say things like, "I feel so sorry for someone who thinks the universe." I can't remember exactly what it was, but, you know, because it's not the universe, it's God. And I was thinking to myself, why do we need to say that? Why can't we just come from the positive side? And in fact, another woman wrote this quote, which I love. She said, in response to the same quote, she wrote, "The moment we let go and trust God in the face of uncertainty and change, opportunities show up in the most unlikeliest of places." In other words, she just said, "I'm not going to say what I'm against. I'm just going to say what I'm for." And I was just reminded, why do we do it? What is in us? Why do we do it? I thought one reason is personality. But, you know, I have to say, I've got a strong judgment personality. Like, if it just said, John, stop smirking. But if it looked at like straight out personality, I'm black and white. Does anyone else have that kind of in them? A few black and whiteers. I like it. I like black and I like white. But what I have come to understand, it is not for me to impose that on everyone else. I think some of the older teachings that I came across when I grew up in church were like that, because they came from personalities probably like me that would just say, no, this is what it is, and you've got to tell everyone, and you've got to tell them what to believe, and you've got to make them believe, and you've got to enforce that they believe it. There was a strong modelling. But I think we also do it because I think we feel the fear, we have fear of other people judging us for not being strong enough in our faith. I think we feel that we might be seen as faithless. And so you think to yourself, oh, heck, I'll make that judgment on someone else. I don't think we think of that in the front of our minds, but I think we realise how much it informs us. We're worried that we'll be seen as being less than Christian. And I think, who cares? Ultimately, the only fear is the final one, which is we fear that God will think we're not being loyal to him. That's the only one we all really should care about. And I think that is a consideration. God, why am I letting that go? Why? In my heart, I just need to be able to honest, because I love you and I'm following your ways and I want to be on your side, which is bringing people into the kingdom. I never find it at all hard to stand up for my faith at all, ever. But so really do I find that I need to use judgment to make that statement. So really, a friend of mine who is Indian and Hindu, and I was with her in India, and she took me to a temple, and she had a dance performance on that we were watching, and was beautiful, this dance performance. And then she turned to me at some point and she said, are you okay? I said, yes, I'm okay. I'm fine. This is beautiful. I said, you do know I'm very spiritual. She turns to me and she says, I know. And one day let's talk about your God. We didn't need to have a big discussion. The truth is that judgment doesn't mean you're not having clarity about what you believe. It's actually, you know what it is? It's that you're looking at yourself first before you even consider applying that filter to someone else. I think our kingdom response is really important. See, kingdomism is about how will we respond. How will we respond? And I think it's really clear how we respond. I think that first of all, we respond by a belief system. We need to think about what we do believe. I think about, what do I believe about all the everyday values of life, about forgiveness, about kindness, about gentleness? Like, we need to have a clarity around our own thinking. I don't think we necessarily think things through about what we do believe, and we're so reactionary when something happens. I think we're also supposed to think about our own actions. How am I living? When I look, I'm so easy and so quick to look at someone else. How am I actually living? And finally, I think we need to have a really clear understanding of what is God trying to do for the whole world and what is his responsibility? Because I know it is God's responsibility to draw people to himself. It's actually his responsibility, and he's abundantly able. It's the Holy Spirit's position to convict people of sin. It's actually God at work in people, and do we not believe that he's able to do it? I honestly wonder. Because I've seen him do it time and time and time and time again with people who I know and love and people who I just meet. And I think I'm called to trust him in it. Beyond my own words. But as well as getting our thinking right, we're actually supposed to get our own heart right. Confession. Gosh, it is good for you and me. Isn't it? Just sit here now, and if you're talking to God right this minute about something you've done the last week, the thought you've had, And just tell me, have we confessed it? Because when we confess, you know what it does? It brings humility. When I say to God, you know, God, I have just got such a bad attitude about that. I just so much want to put them right. I'm just really sorry. It's never going to come from the right spot if I keep this up. Help me. Confession is this internal recalibration, is what I think of it as. We internally recalibrate when we confess. Because without confession, we tend to live a life where we only see things through our own understanding. Confession turns that around. It says, hey, God, what's the kingdom say? I'm sorry. I think it's incredibly important. It's not self-loathing. You know, one of the greatest harms that came into the faith was, and it's a really interesting thing, that in the 80s, where there were so many ministers who fell in really severe public ways, right, in terms of sex and money. And I always just think to myself, if they just had got it right, the kingdom could have launched at that point. But, you know, you and I and my... And that was great to hear from Josh this morning, because it's so true. You and I think sometimes it's those big things that tell people about you. In fact, it's the opposite. It's this little everyday things that you and I are doing. The fact that when someone says to you, you know, well, I can't stand her, she's this or that, and you say, hey, you know what? I don't think about people like that. I'm actually not part, I'm not going to be part of that conversation. When someone wants to talk about your neighbour and her child's behaviours, or that you say, I'm not in it. I've got enough problems of my own. I've got my kids are causing their own confusion. I don't need to look at someone else's. Will we actually just speak for the small? I think God has this amazing way of making it shine big. And then, you know, after getting our belief systems clear, confessing, then comes lifestyle. Then comes the way we live it out. And at West City, we say we love God, we love people, and we follow Jesus. That's what we do. That's our culture. We're going to love God, we're going to love people, and we're going to follow Jesus. And when Jesus says, do not judge lest you be judged, we want to practice it. We want to practice it. You know, Linda, my mother-in-law, has had a bit of a tough trot lately with her health. And she had another situation happen a couple of weeks ago, and she fell. And it was only her and I home alone. It was actually really quite frightening because she fell very heavily. I called the ambulance. Ambulance came, and it's two ambulance drivers. Anyway, I started talking to these ambulance drivers. They said, I'll come in the back of the ambulance. So off we went. Linda's fine, by the way. She's not actually, her strength's not back, but you know what? She's just getting there step by step. So she was, I can assure you, she tells them everything that's what they need to do to get things right when she's got them under. When they're trying to treat her, she's treating them. This time, though, she'd had a little bit of a stroke, they say, on the right side of her face. And she said, I used to say, I'm fine from the neck down. Now I say, I'm fine from the forehead up. They thought that was hilarious. They loved it. Anyway, we're in this ambulance, and when we get to the hospital, I said to the ambulance driver, one of the women who had, you know, we'd been together for about an hour, I said, oh, one of my friends an ambulance driver. And she says, oh, what's her name? I said, her name's Tracy. She says, oh. She says, I know a few Tracys, she says. And she says, there's a religious Tracy. I said, that's my friend. I said, she will be religious Tracy. And so she says, oh, I love her. She says everyone wants to go out with her on the in the bus, you know, in the van, whatever it's called. She's ambulance, I think's the right word. Anyway, everyone wants to go out with her. They said, because she's just hilarious. We have just such a ball. She's always, you know, upbeat and joyous and telling us what's going on in her church. Gosh, faith is loud, isn't it? The kingdom looks so loud, we live it beautifully. She says, how do you know her? I said, I'm religious Kelly, you know. same church background. She said, oh, that's just fabulous, you know. not a Christian girl at all. I thought at the end of it, I thought, you know, when I think about kingdomism, when it comes to judging others, it's simple, really. Judge not, lest you be judged. Judge not, for this is not the kingdom of heaven. Judge not, for God has got the redemption of the world in his hands. Instead, confess our sins, live humbly. Trust God's plan, live faithfully, and practice God's wisdom, lived authentically. And the world will see our good works and glorify our Father who lives in heaven. That's what kingdomism looks like at West City. May we be not theorists, may we be practitioners. And may the world see that he is the most wonderful of fathers and his son, the most wonderful of leaders. Amen.